Hi, I'm Scott Skelton, co-author with Jim Benson of Rod Serling's Night Gallery, an after-hours tour, and Rod Serling's Night Gallery, The Art of Darkness. And I'm here to offer some background on the production of this episode of the series, as well as the series itself. Although originally slated for broadcast on January 21st, 1973, Death on a Barge finally aired on March 4th, long after it was shot. The series had been canceled by NBC in early November of 1972, and the series' remaining episodes were allowed to dribble out until late May of 1973, replaced for a time by Escape, a Jack Webb mid-season replacement.
In this special realm, where the national dish is pumpkin, the national flower is wolfbane.
This eerie tale inspired gallery artist Tom Wright to produce another popular fan favorite.
This was a fun painting to do. Blood red and black, with a beautiful girl floating dead in the canal, lit by the moonlight.
The canal reeds in the foreground and the shadowy wharf in the background add atmosphere to an already striking image.
Simplified, but tells a story.
But reserve such all conclusions.
Leonard Nimoy, everybody's favorite Vulcan science officer and director of some of the better entries in the Star Trek feature franchise, got his behind-the-camera career boost on Night Gallery.
I was on the lot at Universal for a year. I had a one-year contract there to do some acting and potentially to develop some directing projects. And I met Jack Laird, who was producing a series. I had several conversations with him. He had shown a bent for starting new directors, and I guess I just pestered him long enough until finally one day he called me in and said, read this script. And I did. I read it, and I came back to him, and I said I thought very highly of it. I thought it was a wonderful story, a great love story, Romeo and Juliet sort of love story in vampire terms, and he gave me the job.
Nimoy's directorial debut is quite impressive. The opening sequence sets the dreamlike mood exceptionally well. A crane shot that follows Ron down the dock, pulling up and back to include the canal front and the barge with Hyacinth. Atmosphere is heavy, the waterfront misty and strange. The camera locks on Hyacinth's lace-draped hand, following it as she raises it to push her dark hair from her pale, languid face. Although forced to shoot day for night, almost always an ineffective compromise, Nimoy and cinematographer Gerald Perry Finnerman use it to their advantage, creating a netherworld of half-lights and strong evocative color contrasts. Recalls Nimoy.
Jerry and I had spent some time together on Star Trek, and he was very supportive. The tough thing about the job was, and I guess Night Gallery in general, was that the very title, Night Gallery, suggests dark of night, and you could not shoot at night. They wouldn't allow it because it was too expensive. And particularly this show, which was so much exterior night, if you were shooting indoors for night, it didn't matter.
Finnerman concurs.
Every day, I said, I'll shoot this day for night, but you have to do it my way, in backlight. In the afternoon, when the sun is setting in the west, I want to be shooting into the west. And in the morning, when the sun's coming up, I want to be shooting east. And I don't want to shoot sky unless it's really blue. And you just have to work it that way. Otherwise, it won't look good. And Leonard agreed. He was a doll. He was great about it, and we got a good-looking show.
Actress Brooke Bundy, who plays jilted girlfriend Phyllis, makes her appearance here. And there's Lou Antonio, who plays fishmonger Jake. Antonio, like Nimoy, established a successful acting career only to move behind the camera into directing.
I can't make it tonight, Phyllis.
Don't fool around. 500 lire. 3¼. That's my girl.
Nimoy continues.
But shooting exterior for night was extremely difficult because in order to get the night effect, you have to shoot constantly towards the sun so that all of your subject matter is backlit. And then by printing it down, printing your print dark, you get an effect of moonlight. If your subject is front lit, direct head-on front light or sunlight, you can't get that effect. So the whole day, each day, had to be planned in such a way that you were moving around with the sun. And whatever sequence you had to shoot in, you did in order to keep the sun behind the subject. And that was the big trick to get this show done in order to get the look that you're referring to. I think we did manage to get a very good look to the show, but it was not easy. It was really a logistical task.
Yes.
For Nimoy, the casting came easy. He had worked with Leslie Ann Warren the year before in Mission Impossible, and she seemed the ideal choice for Hyacinth. For the part of Ron, relative newcomer Robert Pratt was hired on the strength of his other television work. Together, they would portray the doomed lovers of Halsted Wells' script.
You said you were lonely.
Leslie Ann Warren recalls the production.
It was getting to work with Leonard, which I was really excited to do, thrilled to do, in that capacity with him as a director. When he asked me to do this, I was excited because I knew that it would be a really creative experience with Leonard at the helm. But it was also, she was a complicated character. And coming off of Mission Impossible, where I did get to play a lot of really interesting characters, she was also someone that I thought I could imbue with a lot of different qualities and facets of complex sort of characterization.
Warren's breakout performance was the title role of Rodgers and Hammerstein's 1965 made-for-TV musical Cinderella. After that, she appeared in a pair of Disney movies, made in the wake of Walt's death, when the studio was still trying to find its footing without his guidance. The Happiest Millionaire, with Fred McMurray and Tommy Steele, and the one and only Genuine Original Family Band, with Walter Brennan and Kurt Russell.
No,
following a season as a member of the Impossible Mission Force, she guest starred in some 1970s episodic television, Columbo, Harry O, and of course Night Gallery. She earned rave reviews and an Oscar nomination for her screamingly funny performance as Norma, gangster James Garner's devious gun moll, in Blake Edwards' gender-bending musical comedy, Victor Victoria. Other career high points included the part of Eve, a romantically damaged saloon owner, in Alan Rudolph's romance noir, Choose Me. Then a return to high comedy with her role as Miss Scarlet, trading barbs with Madeline Kahn, Tim Curry, and Martin Mull, in the popular film inspired by the board game Clue. Later in her career, she proved to be a solid character actress with appearances in Steven Soderbergh's neo-noir The Limey with Terrence Stamp, the offbeat S&M romance Secretary with James Spader and Maggie Gyllenhaal, and a raft of returning guest roles on Will and Grace and Desperate Housewives. Character actor Jim Bowles plays Hyacinth's father, the old peg-legged salt cursed with imprisoning and finally dispatching his own daughter. He played a similarly seaworthy role for another gallery segment, Lindemann's Catch, from season 2, in which he played a dockside innkeeper. It's easy to see why he has to keep her on that barge. What sentient being wouldn't find themselves risking their immortal soul for a chance at Warren's Hyacinth? She succeeds in being both wraith-like and deliciously carnal at the same time, luxuriating in the doomed, tortured vampire prototype with its historical suggestion of sexual hunger. She definitely hits the bullseye in her performance. When reading the script to Death on a Barge, Warren immediately keyed into the ambivalence and desolation of her tragic character.
You know, I really focus on her loneliness and her need to be, in a weird way, saved and rescued from her own life as a vampire, knowing that she couldn't be saved, but her desire to have love and her conflict about not wanting to hurt him was interesting to me and appealing to me, and her history as a vampire took over and took precedence over her not really wanting him to be hurt. So there were a lot of conflicting emotions, conflicting states of mind in that situation, if that makes sense. You know, I think the scene where she's giving in to her desire, luring him to her, even though she knows she's going to destroy him. I remember I had to sort of make a choice to be completely uninhibited in that way. And I did. And I was.
The scriptwriter for this adaptation was Halsted Wells, a frequent contributor to Night Gallery. He was a full-fledged stage playwright who at the time was admired for penning two classic big-screen psycho-westerns for director Delmer Daves in the late 50s, 310 to Yuma and The Hanging Tree. Wells declared, Quote, somewhere along the line I got tagged as a Western specialist, but I also write adventure, horror, and just plain romance. Unquote. Certainly Death on a Barge exemplifies two of the dramatist's fortes. A Yale graduate, Wells spent his early years teaching English and dramatics at Robert College in Istanbul, Turkey, then returned to attend Yale University's School of Drama. After graduating, he remained as an instructor and director of the Yale Dramatic Association for 5 years, then taught at Smith College as its resident playwright for 3 years. Following his stint in academia, he spent 4 years abroad, touring England, Europe, Russia, and the Near East. Wells's chief interest at the time was theatrical directing. He made the move from Rhode Island summer stock to the Great White Way, and over a 12-year period from the mid-1930s to the late 40s, directed several Broadway plays, including one which he himself had written. Around 1948, Wells made a decision to devote his time solely to writing, producing a number of radio and television scripts in addition to plays for the legitimate stage. In 1953, the West Coast sustained a marked increase in television and film production, with a resulting movement of that industry from New York to California. Following that movement, Wells began obtaining assignments from California producers for writing and adapting literary material for television screenplays. A heavy contributor in the days of early television, Wells scripted regularly for Suspense, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Kraft Suspense Theater, which is where he met Jack Laird, and later, Kojak. Don't look so sad. For Night Gallery, he wrote 6 scripts, including top segments like The Phantom Farmhouse, The Sins of the Fathers, The Dark Boy, and The Return of the Sorcerer. One night. As was his practice for every assignment, he visited locations and researched extensively. In an interview from the period, he said, quote, if you can't go there in person, you get books and study up on it. I never met a werewolf or a devil in person, but I've written several Night Gallery plays about them. It's rather exhilarating to lose yourself in a werewolf or a devil. Expands your personality. Unquote. Wells felt that the main qualification for writing in any genre was, quote, a knack for losing yourself in the people you write about, for jumping into whatever special world they live in and making it your own. Unquote. Filming Death on a Barge was an overwhelmingly positive experience for Warren, although in one sequence came close to hitting her panic button.
You had to climb into a coffin. Did it freak you out?
And that was scary for me, because I'm definitely claustrophobic. It's so terrifying for me, and I wouldn't let them close it. I wouldn't let them. I just kept saying, nope, you have to keep it open a little bit. You have to keep it open. And if you can sort of see in this one that they do the way that they shot it, it looks like it's going to be closed, but it never was closed fully because it was way too scary for me.
That's the 475, please.
You sickest thing I ever knew. Look, it's my life, okay? And I'm not going to live it square. I like risk. Thank you.
Although much of the script was well done, it did exhibit a few problems. Halsted Wells punctuates his script with the vernacular of the time. Death on a Barge has uncomfortable moments where the dialogue is an obvious attempt to emulate the hip jive of the 1970s generation.
What about her spook teeth? About 3.5 pounds?
That'll be fine.
I don't get you. If you really believe all that stuff, believe the whole trip, why are you so crazy to see her?
I'm drawn to her. I dig her strangeness. I dig her mystery. But most of all, I just plain want to know.
Know what?
The truth. Is she for real? Is a vampire for real?
Dialogue like that ensures this segment doesn't age as well as some other episodes.
Why don't you stay home tonight?
Why don't I stay home? Why don't you stay home?
What do you mean?
In my opinion, for what it's worth, a weakness exists in this episode that has nothing to do with the script, but the casting. In Everell Worrell's short story, Hyacinth is a loveless creature motivated by hunger. When Hyacinth realizes Ron will not succumb to her, she then uses him to get other victims. In Halsted Wells' adaptation, however, Hyacinth is a loving, lonely creature who returns Ron's interest and reaches out to him emotionally. And yet, the audience is offered almost no basis for her interest in him. As portrayed by the bland Robert Pratt, Ron is a pretty big zero. Pratt was a contract player at Universal at the time. The studio kept trying to make his career happen, but it stalled out in 1977 and apparently never recovered. And his Callow performance here gives damning evidence as to why. The audience never sees a relationship develop between Hyacinth and Ron beyond a tentative chat across the canal. But from such a weak exchange, an all-consuming passion for each other is supposed to have sprung. That, coupled with the uneven lead performances, ensures that the motivational algebra just doesn't add up in this segment. Part of the problem, however, stems from the writer having so little time to develop characters and relationships with the series' new half-hour time slot. Complicating the shooting of this episode were the newly established Universal tour trams traversing the back lot, recalls Nimoy.
The trams were new and were bothersome. When the trams first started coming around, the assistant directors would ask them to stop and be quiet. You know, the tour guys would be talking over their PA system, and they would ask them to stop and be quiet while we were shooting. Well, then the edict came down that you don't stop the tram, you stop the shooting. And it was quickly apparent that the most important thing at Universal was the tourist business. And it was difficult. It made it difficult. Here they are over there shooting Night Gallery. I wonder who that is starring in this episode. Can you recognize anybody over there? It's Night Gallery, the famous show that you've seen on Thursday night. Yeah. There it is, right there, folks. They're shooting a vampire show this week, and it is shut up.
Contributing to the circus atmosphere was the arrival of some surprise guests to the set. From an interview from the period, Nimoy was quoted thus, quote, "While we were shooting Death on a Barge, we had a couple of distinguished visitors. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and Anatoly Dobrynin, the Soviet ambassador. Kissinger's young son David, it turned out, was a Star Trek fan. While I signed an autograph for him, I mentioned my Russian heritage to Ambassador Dobrynin and the fact that my parents had emigrated to the U.S. in the 1920s. I had been interested in returning to my parents' native land for many years." "Ah," said the ambassador, "have they ever returned to the Soviet Union for a visit? And have you ever been?" The answers to both questions was no. "Then you should go," he said, "and bring them with you," unquote. During their tour of Universal Studios, the high-level VIPs and their families surveyed the sound stages and met with the casts of various NBC shows, among them McLeod and Macmillan and wife. Young David Kissinger, carrying a White House memo pad, secured the autographs of such celebrities as Rock Hudson, Dean Martin, Dennis Weaver, and others. On the set of Ironside, after star Raymond Burr finished signing for his young fan, David Kissinger apparently asked him for another autograph for a friend of his. Acquiring autographs from this galaxy of NBC TV stars must have had a profound impact on the eager 10-year-old, because David Kissinger grew up to become president of NBC Universal Television, developing such award-winning shows as The Office, House MD, Monk, and Law & Order Special Victims Unit.
That's why I'm...
Leslie Ann Warren was not on the set when the dignitaries were visiting. However, her disappointment was lessened to a great degree because 2 years earlier, the young actress personally broke bread with the esteemed Secretary of State.
I did meet him a couple of years before that, actually. I was dating Robert Evans. We were having dinner at his house, and Henry Kissinger was his guest for the evening, and he was spending the night there. So I actually got to spend some time with him. And I was completely intimidated. The combination of Bob Evans and Henry Kissinger was just, I think I was probably just in a state of overwhelm in a way, you know?
Don't come back. Ever.
Nimoy's chance meeting with Henry Kissinger and Ambassador Dobrynin on the set of Night Gallery served as an inspiration for the first-time director. Over the years, Nimoy waited for a chance to someday return to his Russian roots, and in 1988, he got it. While celebrating the country's moratorium on whaling, the World Wildlife Fund invited Nimoy to Moscow. When the group sponsored a special screening of the Nimoy-directed feature film Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, Nimoy immediately flew to the Soviet Union to attend. This afforded him the opportunity to meet with long-lost relatives, fulfilling his decades-long aspiration to return to his roots.
Oh.
Ultimately, what emerges from this episode is a moody and effective fantasy. Nimoy himself was quite pleased with the outcome.
I was quite pleased with it. I liked the story all from the beginning. I found it interesting and dramatic and scary, and I found the characters attractive. I thought both Leslie and Robert did wonderful work. I enjoyed doing it a lot. It was hard because we were constantly under pressure for speed.
Despite Death on a Barge being Nimoy's first effort behind the camera, he demonstrated in full all the attributes and instincts of an experienced, accomplished director.
He definitely is an actor's director. He's very sensitive as an actor and very sensitive as a director. He understands the process of acting and how one arrives at the desired result and has great sensitivity towards that. We would have lots of talks on set about acting and about what was important to each one of us in the art of acting. And we were very in sync in that way, creatively. And, you know, created an atmosphere that made you feel safe, secure, protected, so that you could really go the distance with your choices.
Apparently, the producer appreciated the work of his new director as well. Recalled Nimoy,
immediately after I was done, Jack Laird offered me another episode, which I couldn't do because I had accepted a job to go off and act in a production of Oliver in Milwaukee. So I couldn't do it. I felt badly because I thought, gee, I'm just getting started with my directing career and I'm stepping on my own foot here, leaving town, you know. But it was a wonderful experience. I really appreciated being given the chance to do it.
It was just as well Nimoy couldn't accept. The assignment Laird offered was, without a doubt, the series' worst script, Hatred Unto Death, which was the final episode of Night Gallery to be broadcast on its initial network run. It was also written, sadly, by Halsted Wells. As to the series' brutal cancellation, after NBC executive Larry White closed the coffin lid on Night Gallery, the network continued airing the series, with periodic preemptions, over the next 10 weeks. But a funny thing happened on the way to the cancellation graveyard. Suddenly, Rod Serling's Night Gallery became the series that wouldn't die, as reported by Forrest Powers of the Minneapolis Star on February 27, 1973. Quote, "There is at least one series a network can kick at, stomp on, and even cancel that manages to die hard. Night Gallery, Rod Serling's collection of weird stories, was first an hour-long show, then was trimmed to a half hour and eventually canceled in January. Night Gallery will be revived Sunday night for a segment entitled Death on a Barge. The show will replace NBC TV's Escape series, which premiered February 11th and hasn't been seen since. The segment of Escape was called Lost, and if NBC ever finds it, the show may be carried sometime in the spring. Meanwhile, Night Gallery on Sunday will deal with a guy in love with a woman who lives on a barge. The problem is that she won't let him on the boat. NBC goes on to say that remaining segments of Night Gallery will resume May 13th. It's a funny way to cancel a series and also to try to get a new one on the road." Unquote. And this is the final, bitterly ironic twist that attended its finish. As its final season played out, Night Gallery, with its production canceled, its crew dispersed to other projects, and without a chance for reprieve, won the best ratings of its broadcast run, regularly beating its competition. Furthering that irony, the show's worst episode, Hatred Unto Death, scored gargantuan ratings, finishing in the top 10, number 8 in the Nielsen's for the week of May 27th, 1973.
I have to do this, you understand?
As you plunge it in, cry out that you love me.
For Leslie Ann Warren, Death on a Barge was her first and only foray into the macabre. A veteran of scores of movie and television roles, Warren considers her experience on Night Gallery a career highlight, one that left an indelible impression.
I'm so proud of it. You know, it was fun for me to see it again. You know, I think it's really, it has a great mood and sort of ambiance, and I love the character of Hyacinth, and I'm very proud of the work. because I've never done anything in horror since, I'm excited that I got to do that and be at least a part of a very classic, beloved horror anthology.
Thanks for listening to this commentary. At the time of this taping, the second edition of my book, Rod Serling's Night Gallery, an after-hours tour, co-authored with Jim Benson, is set for release sometime in fall of 2022. Massively expanded and researched, fully illustrated with color and black and white photos, and more than twice its original length, it's for all practical purposes an entirely new book. For fans of the series, of Rod Serling, and of television history, we feel it's a must-read. We hope you take a look at it.